Welcome, everybody. It's Dempner here. Great to have you on another podcast for iloverealestate.tv. Now, if you haven't subscribed, please jump on the website, www.iloverealestate.tv, and subscribe to the iTunes so that you can have this downloaded to you automatically. And, you know, there's a link there on the website just up on the right-hand corner. So follow those links, subscribe to the website, and there's all sorts of good stuff there for you to have. Now, today I want to talk about a situation that arose out of me talking to a gardener, actually. He wasn't one of my students and he didn't know what I do or anything like that. And I was sitting down chatting to him just about general stuff, as I do. I mean, I talk to everybody, regardless of whether I'm at the airport or the shopping center or sitting down waiting for my daughter to come out of a shop, as that was this case today. And I was chatting to this guy, and he was talking about the government and change of politics and all of that kind of stuff. And one of the things that that came out of the whole process was real estate. I seem to be able to manage to twist the conversation to real estate quite easily these days. I think I've had a lot of practice. But he was talking about prices of properties, and he was talking about this deal that he had put a contract on something and then it didn't work and something else didn't work. And no matter what I suggested or anything else, he had this attitude of it didn't work. So I just wanted to talk to you today about that whole attitudinal process. And it made me think about deals in the past where your initial reaction is an obstacle. You know, your initial endeavor might be to offer a certain price or to to do things a certain way, and then the seller or the buyer, whichever side you're on, you know, doesn't agree with that. Or it might not even be a real estate deal. It might be a negotiation with a child, or it might be an interaction with a school teacher or whoever. And it astounds me that the initial reaction of most people who are not skilled, I guess, in the art of negotiation, who are not trained, who haven't gone through any kind of educational thought processes about the way things are done, that they've got this defeatist attitude. And it's about, well, I can't do it. No, didn't work, you know. The immediate reaction is defeatist. Where in reality, when I think back in my past and deals that I'm doing now and deals that I've done in the past, your immediate response is often a no. And it's then about, okay, how can I make this deal work? How can I get the desired result that I want? How can I create a real win-win situation? And that's what it's about. It's really about creating that win-win scenario for both parties. Now, in order to do that, you've got to put yourself in the shoes of the other person. And I want to go through some of the processes that I use to help with that, and, you know, to get the desired outcome, whether it be the right price for the sale of a property, whether it be to buy the property at a right price, whether it be trying to get your child to go and do something that you really want them to do and you know that you're going to come up with obstacles in that regard, or a spouse or whoever. So I want to talk through those processes, because this is something that you can apply to any scenario, whether it be real estate or not. These tools that I'm going to go through now are very, very important, and they really give you the opportunity to cruise through life in a how can I make this happen mode, as opposed to a defeatist, negative. When you go through that negative mind frame of, oh, you know, I can't make it happen, this didn't work, they said no, then you get caught quite often in the blame game, which is very, very detrimental to your health. It is very, very detrimental to your persona. And I can tell you now, it's very, very detrimental to your success. So to help me out with today's podcast, I thought I'd invite my old mate back again, Mr. Ian Ugarte. Hey there, how are you?
Hi, old mate.
Yes, he happens to be younger than me, but anyway, we won't go into that. Hey, Ian, how are you?
I'm good. How are you? Thank you for having me on again.
Very good, I am, and great to have you here. Now, the reason I've got you here, Ian, is because you are a master craftsman in unusual deals, let's say. I don't think you've had a deal go in a straightforward manner ever, have you?
No. For us, when we do deals, it's always something different. It's more about, the situation we're at the time, how much funds we have available, or when we know that we've sold a property and there's funds coming available, so that means extended settlements and access prior so we can do some renovation, or permission to go to council before we actually own it. So there's a lot of things that we do when we bring into strategy when we're dealing with a possibility of doing a purchase.
Okay, so what I'd like to do for the purpose of the podcast is teach all the listeners a little bit more about the structure behind gaining a desired outcome. And one of the things that I really want to start with is research. Because the more you know about a particular situation, the more you can start to put the pieces together of a true win-win scenario. So from a research perspective, I mean, I know from my side of things, research is paramount. You know, you being prepared is another way of describing research. Knowing as much as you possibly can about every single whim or their process for doing things, their reasons behind why they want to do this or that, their personality, what their buttons are. Now, something that I've found over the years, and this has really just come from experience, is that price is not always the determining factor. And price, for most people, if you're on the other end of it, you think price is the be-all and end-all, where in reality, I mean, I've seen deals done over a lawnmower. I don't know about you, Ian, but there's certainly deals that are done over really strange objects of furniture or a mirror on the wall or a piece of stained glass window, that's what crunches the deal. Now, I know you've had one quite recently on some crystals, I hear.
Yeah, that we do have one deal that's happening where there was crystal caves all over the property, and it just happened that my wife and his wife had something in common. Even more peculiar about another deal is the clincher to the deal was really the three cats that had passed away in the time that she'd lived there.
I've forgotten about that one.
Yeah, and in that deal there, it wasn't about the money. It was actually about a lack of money. She wanted to make sure that she didn't have too much money in the bank account when she was finished, because she didn't want to lose a pension, which was a little bit crazy, but I was happy to deal with that. And and the real clincher was the fact that she had three pets that were her life, and she had been there for 30 years. She had buried them in the front yard. And I had to...
I hope they were dead at the time.
They were dead when she buried them. I'm not going to give my comment on cats, but... and so what she wanted to do was she actually wanted those bones taken with her to the next property. So
So you became a grave digger.
Yes, and it was a large undertaking, I have to say. So, and I wasn't sure about how she was going to be when I was digging them up. And the majority of the bones had decayed away, but you could see the skulls and bits and pieces, and I was expecting her to break down, but for her it was just physically taking them, and there was no emotional breakdown or anything. She sat on the front step with a cup of tea, and we dug it up, we put it into a polystyrene box, and I took it to the new place and we put it in the yard there, and she was quite happy.
My goodness. Well, I think that tops the cake. I've had pool tables make a deal. I've had ride-on mowers. I've had a tractor make a deal, but I've never had cat's bones.
Mm. I have.
Cat's bones. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about exploring that, that process. Because when you're talking to somebody, you've really got to be on the lookout for what pushes their buttons. And there's a number of ways that can be done. I'm very much the face person. I like to see the person I'm talking to. I like to deal directly. I really don't like dealing through a real estate agent if I can possibly help it, because not that I'm trying to cut them out of the deal. They're very valuable people. But I just want to feel the energy of the other person. I want to see their body language. you know, I want to be there to, when they say something or they might hesitate at a certain point, I want to be there so that I can pick up on that and then angle my questions a little bit differently to the way I would if that hadn't happened. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and really it's when you are face-to-face, you can actually have empathy for the other side. And recent deal, the same thing, that they'd been trying to sell a property for a long time. We didn't want to buy the property outright because we would have had to pay stamp duty on it, and we just wanted to do a joint venture with the owners. And because they'd been trying to sell it for such a long time, you know, I automatically picked up that she hated getting the house ready for open houses. And I said, well, you know, I can understand how difficult it is for you to have to clean the house for 2 hours before every time someone comes in. And so I was showing empathy for the fact, and saying to her, by saying that to her, I was saying, well, let's cut that out. Let's make sure it shortens up and we can get a sale for you so you don't have to continue to do that. So, yeah, I mean, making sure that they
picking up on those signals.
Yeah, and it was obvious that she hated doing it, so that's why we did. And you know, structurally, we also look at the structural reason behind the sale as well. Doing the research, using the tools for the research to make sure that we can sort of put a picture together before we even sit down and talk to them face to face.
And what you mean by that is, like, when they bought it, how much they bought it for, you know, whether they've done any extensions or DAs on it, or how long it's been on the market or not. You know, how much is rented for in the past, if anything. So all of that background, straight out fact stuff, you put together that all into a bit of a file so that you can start to formulate the picture before you even, as you say, sit down and talk to the guy.
Yeah, where we are currently looking for a new PPR because we've sold ours.
Principal place of residence for all of those who aren't up on the jargon.
I'm a Mr. Acronym. We call them, in TAFE New South Wales, we call them TLA, three-letter acronyms. So, yeah, we're looking for a new home, and we found one that we quite like. So we looked, we started to do the research. We saw when they bought it in 03 and how much they paid for it. And then we started to research the other properties that they've bought. Now, they've only bought one other property, and the other property that they bought in 2007 or 2008, they obviously revalued their current one
to buy
the new house as a deposit, and then put their house on the market. So since 2007, they've been trying to sell it. And so the picture there is that we obviously understand that in whatever the value was in 2007, they're looking for 80% of that value because the area has dropped in price.
Yep.
So they're trying to get that loan paid out directly so they don't have to chip any money in. So that picture there gives us a starting point of how we can start negotiating.
That's very clever. And, you know, it's something that comes with education. I mean, gosh, how long have you been a student of mine? 4 years or something?
Yeah, 4 years.
4 years, okay. And, you know, prior to that, a lot of that due diligence perhaps wouldn't have been done, certainly not in the same extent that you do it now. But when you look at the creating that picture, simply knowing how to go in and do a search on somebody, find out every property that they own, when they bought it, how much they paid for it, and in that scenario you just set up there was very important, because if you can see when they bought another property and how much they paid for that, obviously they're going to cross-securitise, much as I hate it, but that's what they do. And the one property is used as security for the other. So you can basically paint a picture as to how much they owe on the property because of how much deposit they would have needed for the other one. And other little clues that you can get along the way, like if they'd applied to put a pool in, okay, well, where'd the money from that come from? You know, when you add the cost of the pool going in, or, you know, they put an extension on the house, where you can see how big the extension was, the square meterage of the extension. You can see basically on a square meter basis, you can estimate how much that would have cost them. And barring great Aunt Bertha dying and leaving them a swag of money, it's probably come out of the equity in the house. So you can start to work out roughly how much they owe on their property. And then, as you say, when they're in a pressure situation like your scenario there, you can work out what their bottom line figure is. And that's pretty crafty, really.
Yeah, and you can also, with all of that, we research their history of trying to sell the property since 2007. So you know where they started at. You look at all the properties around that that have been selling that are similar, and you can, and again, you can gauge a picture of what that property is actually really worth according to what they're trying to get out of the deal for.
So. Yeah.
Mm. And you know, that all comes from learning as well, because I've been in that situation before where I'm trying to get a price set in my head according to my story and how that went along.
Yeah, that's right, as opposed to what the market will really bear.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so you find out that. Now, that's all of the practical, statistical type stuff that you can work out and, you know, you gauge a picture. We're now sitting down and talking to the guy, either with or without the real estate agent in the middle. I don't mind the real estate agent being there, but I prefer to be face-to-face because you can pick up, as I say, on all of that body language stuff. I know a friend of mine, she works in a legal office, or used to work in a legal office, and she's very articulate on paper. And she likes to deal through letters and legal, you know, letters and handwritten letters when it's appropriate and that kind of stuff. But she writes exceptionally well, I might add. It's not my thing. It's not my strength. And I think a lot of things can be perhaps misconstrued through the written word, or you don't pick up on the feelings and the emotions behind it necessarily, or I certainly don't. I'm a face-to-face person. I prefer to, you know, to see the little hesitation or the flutter in their voice, or the little muscle in the side of their mouth that twitches or whatever. I'm very much into the body language side of things. And that's not everybody. How do you stand on that one, Ian?
I do like to sit down in front of people and talk to them, but I can also I like to write a story and put, when we're putting an offer together, I normally bring the family into it and how we're looking forward to a new house and because we've been transient for a while, or we paint a story for the real estate agent to be able to pass it on. I'm the same. I prefer to. Even I don't care if the real estate agent's there, but I always try to set up a face-to-face meeting, cup of coffee type stuff.
Yeah.
And I have knocked on a few vendors' doors where we actually do get knock on the door because the real estate agent is not working in our favour. I've done the deal with the vendor and then gone back to the agent and said, I'm not cutting you out of the deal. I'm not sure that you'll be happy.
Just talk about that deal, because that's a deal that I know which one you're talking about there. Just explain how that deal went down and explain why the seller was selling his property.
Yeah, look, it was a deal that we'd looked at it twice, and the agent had taken us. It was very difficult to get in because the tenants there was two tenants in the property for a three tenancy place. He undergraded the place the whole time we were there. Why would you buy this when you could buy two units and it'd have the same return? And you know, we went backwards and forwards. I actually then went to the email, told him, you know, this is what we're looking forward to, having a house to live in and whatever. And then we put the deal together and asked him to put it to the vendor. He came back to us pretty quickly and said, oh, no, the vendor doesn't want that deal. And it was an extended settlement because we had money coming in. So we went, so there was nothing. We couldn't do anything. The guy and the sat on the market for 3 months. And so eventually we took some advice and we went and knocked on the vendor's door. Opened it up. He was an old Greek guy. And on the front, I asked him whether the deal had been put to him. And he said, oh, not really. The agent said it wasn't worth looking at. So I told him the deal. And we've been told that he didn't want the extended settlement. He actually told us that he'd prefer the extended settlement because he had tenants in there for quite a long time and he wanted to make sure that they found a place quite easily. So that was great. We actually moved into it early. So once we got the deal, I did the deal on the front porch, went back to the agent and I said to him, look, you're not going to be happy with what I've just done, but I've just negotiated a deal with the vendor directly. I'm not cutting you out of the deal. Can you please, this is the deal. Can you please put a sales advice together because we're buying that property? That agent is known for downgrading properties and possibly purchasing some himself, and some of them do that. All friends of theirs will do it. So not all agents are like that. The majority aren't like that, but that one particular has been known for it. Anyway, as the story goes, the more we found out about the vendor, he was given advice that he needs to sell that property because it was going to affect his pension. So
his accountant told him to sell it because it's going to affect his pension.
Yeah, and so he gave up. At the time, the place was being rented for $430 together, so he gave up $430 a week for a $117 pension.
Unbelievable. And it astounds me that he could think that and that was the right thing to do, but it astounds me even more that the accountant gave him that advice. I mean, it's just ridiculous for any professional to say give up 470 and accept 117 or whatever it was. But you do get
you get a pension card.
Pension card.
Yeah, so you get to travel on the bus for free.
Oh, whoopee.
And you get dental, you know. But, you know, the other part of that advice from the accountant was that he was going to gift the money to his children, which I think you know better than I do, but I'm not sure that he could have done that anyway.
No, that would have – you've got a five-year cooling-off period, basically, for want of a better word, that if he had done that, then it would be counted as being his money anyway for a further 5 years, and it would be deemed to be invested at the deeming rate for pensions, which I think is around about 5% at the moment.
So he wouldn't have got his pension anyway.
No, it would have been deemed to have that money invested at 5% anyway.
Right.
So the accountant wasn't real smart, I would say, on that one.
No, he wasn't. But we got a good deal, so it was good.
You did get a good deal. Okay. Let's get back to what we're supposed to be talking about here.
Yes, yes.
And that is preparation. I mean, I cannot underestimate this. You cannot underestimate this. This is something I cannot emphasize enough, is that preparation is paramount when it comes to, to getting your desired outcome on a deal and finding out as much as you possibly can about the factual side behind a deal, either as a buyer or a seller, as well as the personal issues behind the sale as well. I remember one deal I did, the couple was going to, they actually already bought a Winnebago, and were heading off around Australia, and they just wanted to be done, finished, gone, get me out of here. And I was actually able to negotiate a reduction in price because there was a few things that needed fixing. And you can either do it as a rebate or a reduction in the purchase price. Because I said, well, look, you know, you can fix them if you like, but we'll have to delay the settlement or if we hold back this much money, then I'll get the things fixed and, you know, we can settle on the actual date. And timing in that issue was more important to them than the extra 15 grand, which was what the holdback was on the purchase price. So I got a $15,000 reduction during the contract period, because they want a quick sale. They just want to get out of there and start their road trip.
Yeah, and that preparation there is really important, making sure that you're setting yourself up at the beginning of the meeting, that you've got strategies that you're going to use to start with. But during the meeting, it's really important because some meetings don't go the way you expect them to and you need some fallback plans. So I make sure, Christine and myself, so my wife and myself, we sit down before a meeting and we have the different strategies, and we work really well together in meetings. I do most of the talking because I talk a lot, but Christine's very good in the background offering a little bit of extra to help with what I'm trying to say, to emphasise the points that we're trying to emphasise. And it's about, again, making sure that both parties are winning out of the deal, that, you know... Sometimes I use different strategies. Sometimes I bombard them with give a lot of information out about the deal that we're trying to do, and other times I only trickle information out so that you can control the conversation in a way. So when I'm comfortable in doing a fairly simplistic deal in normal terms or close to normal terms, I like to give them a whole lot of extra terms and then work our way backwards from that. So it actually gives a point of advantage to me to be able to say to them, rightio, well, these are all the deals. Look, I'm happy to pull the the longer settlement out. And then that way they feel that there's a compromise being made and we work back. If I'm trying to get extra things happen, then I try actually to get a simple deal done by price, and then I work on the extra bits from there and add on as we go, rather than hitting them all up front, and you know, and then maybe not doing the deal.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I really want to talk about on this podcast is about that how can I attitude. And, you know, you really emphasized it there with you know, talking about, okay, well, we do our preparation. You go in, you know what your benchmarks are. You know what your pull-out price is. You know what your pull-out conditions are. And you've got that bigger picture around the other person about what motivates them. You know, is it price? Is it terms? Is it the ride-on mower? What are the things that really motivate that person, and what are the things that are going to be trigger points for them? And really thinking, okay, how can I make this deal happen? Now, I remember negotiating on a property in the last 6 months, I suppose, where the outright answer was no, we're not doing this deal. No, we can't agree to your terms. No, you know, the price is wrong, all the rest of it. So I actually said to the guy, okay, well, how can we do the deal? What do we have to do? What are your figures? What are your benchmarks that I have to meet in order to do this deal today? And he rattled off a few things, and I said, all right, let's list them out. And we wrote it out, and I said, okay, let's work around. We'll you know, see what else can be done to make this happen, and whether it be, you know, caveats or other security or all sorts of other things come in about, okay, well, how can I keep you in a position that you're comfortable and still get what I want or very close to what I want? And it's having that attitude. The thing about the attitude is the biggest thing, because if you can conquer the how can I attitude as opposed to, you know, I want to do it this way, it's my way or the highway, or, oh no, he said no, and that's the end of it. And I deal with this a lot with the students where they'll say, okay, well, this has happened and that's happened. And it may not even be a purchase or a sell. It might be, you know, I was talking to one the other day. The town planner said that they can't build in underneath a particular house because the sewerage outlet was too high or something to that effect. And I said, okay, well, that might be the case. And the solution that he was saying, you're going to have to raise the property. But that was going to cost $40,000. I'm going, well, that's a lot of money. How else can we do it cheaper? And we sat down and brainstormed a little bit, and by possibly putting within a certain distance of the sewerage breather, you're going to know more about this, Ian, than I am, because you're the plumber, not me, but whatever, if you can call that storage, then the rest is far enough away that it doesn't have to be. And he hadn't thought of that. And I thought, I don't know whether that's right or wrong or what, you know, what else you can do, but there must be another way. It may even be cheaper to drop the sewerage line breather thing. I'm very technical here. Yeah, no,
you're going good. I mean, the other thing too is that I try never to leave a negotiation with no. I always keep the door open. And so I normally leave with, well, look, let's have a think about it. I know you're not quite in the ball game at the moment, or words to that effect, but how about, can I give you a call in a couple of weeks and just, we might be able to find, I'll go away and have a think about things and you can think about things and, you know, we might be able to work something out. Now, that happened to me recently in a we're trying to get an option deal, and It was a flat out no, I'm not interested, the family's not interested, and we're going to lose out and whatever. So, but I did leave the door open. By the end of the conversation of saying to him, look, can I call you in a couple of weeks, that meant that the conversation continued, and it went from him not wanting an option for us to purchase his property to him actually purchasing part of our property, because that's what he wanted to do. And since then, I've also thought, well, I can purchase more of his property if he doesn't want to sell the whole lot, because he does, and we could do a boundary realignment. So all those things, when you walk away, start to pop into your head, and just think a little bit outside the square, and other things come into your mind. And for them, possibly the same thing happens. I've got one vendor JV going at the moment. We have a good discussion around the table, and he goes away and thinks about it, and that's dangerous. So we've got to come and have another meeting and pull him back into the reality of what the situation is. But that's fine, and that's a continuum. So I know in that situation there, where he goes away and thinks about it, and he's a financial guy, so he thinks about money, not about the actual circumstances, we have learnt that it's important to make sure that we've got his wife at the table, because she's the one that brings clarity into the relationship. He looks at numbers and she looks at logistics. So that's something we've learnt again about that particular situation.
And something else that is vitally important is getting an understanding in writing as soon as possible.
Oh, absolutely. So a lot of I like to use a lot of technology when we are talking, and so I always have my iPad with me, and I've downloaded an app that's called SoundNote. There's a free version called Evernote, but essentially during the conversation, before the conversation starts, I allow them the privilege of knowing that I'm recording the conversation. So
I assume you ask.
That's right, I ask. I say, do you realise that I'm recording the conversations? It's more so that I've got something to go back to and listen to in the future. If I don't ask them for the recordings, it means I can't use it in any way legally. But the beauty about that that application is that during the conversation, I can write a word. So 20 minutes into the conversation, if we're writing something about the cost of subdivision, I can put cost of subdivision in. When I go to listen to it in the next couple of weeks, I can just hit the word cost of the words cost of subdivision, and the recording will automatically go to that point. So I don't have to listen to the last 20 minutes. I can just listen to that point there.
That's pretty cool.
It's a really good application. And then at the end, what I normally do is I email those notes to the people that we're talking to, we're negotiating with. If we are doing an MOU, I will then do.
Hang on, you Mr.
Acronym. Sorry, TLA again. Sorry. once we've discussed and we've got all the terms, I verbally confirm that the way. So I always say the way that I understand what we've just spoken about is this point, this point, this point, because what I understand may be different to the person on the other side of the table.
Agree.
Once that's clarified, I then write it down in SoundNote, so that I've got that we've got a memorandum of understanding between the two. And if we've got access to a printer, I print out two copies there and we both sign them, just as so that we're both. I mean, the days of handshakes, unfortunately, for me, you can handshake all day if you want, but unfortunately, the handshake days are gone. And so
you're saying your handshake days are gone, or generally?
No, generally in the population, you can handshake with me all day. So we get to sign it. It makes sure that both of us are on the same page, literally, and that we're moving forward in a positive direction with the agreement.
Mm. This is where the whole age thing really comes out in full force, I'm afraid, here, because I'm not quite as techie as you are. You know what I do? I bring out a piece of paper. Have you heard of one of them, Ian? Piece of paper and a pen.
Pen?
A pen. And I actually write. I hand write.
I see.
And up the top of the page I put memorandum of understanding.
with a papyrus read?
Not quite. And I write out, we understood, now let's just confirm that, and I write out what we said and I write out the next point. And that in itself, for me, I like it because it slows the process down. It really emphasises what we have agreed on, and you know, the guys or the girl is sitting there, they're nodding about, yep, that's what we said. Oh, make sure you put this in, and they'll add to it. So it becomes a document that we have put together, which if you're dealing with anybody older than you, my age, and older than me particularly, it's more about, you know, the technology is great, but it's not as meaningful as let's write this document together, handwritten, and let's sign it, and then we'll give it to the lawyers and they can write it up in all their legal jargon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just for the record, I have written things out before.
You know what a pen and a paper is.
Yeah, once. So, look, the other part of negotiation too, we've actually negotiated and got to the point where we've realised that we're actually going to be, that the person on the other side of the table is going to be worse off, and we've actually walked away from those deals. You know, I can give a situation where she was ill. She had a terminal disease, and her husband had an accident as well, and they weren't in a good position, and we were going to go in and do a vendor JV, fix the place up and sell it. But essentially what was going to happen was that they were going to have to take out a personal loan because their property had dropped in value, and they would have had a personal loan and no home. So what we did was we said to them, look, you're going to be far worse off if we do this deal. We talk to them about what they could do to actually put their place, to put themselves in a better situation. So we changed them from, we made sure that they were stopped playing principal on the property and just paid interest, and then they had, for, with a little bit of work, they put a granny flat into the property. They moved into the granny flat and rented the house, and then that way the house wasn't costing them on a weekly basis like it was, because they weren't earning enough. They were eating into themselves, basically. So in that deal there, I won't do a deal where someone's worse off. I'll walk away from it.
Yeah.
So, and the other thing we like to do is what I like to call the red herring, where you put a large amount of emphasis on a part of a deal where you actually not, you really don't care about that component of it, but you show that you do care. And so when you give that up again, it's a compromise. I remember when I was doing...
That's called acting, isn't it?
No, it's not acting. It's just using potential. and so I remember when I was doing business at TAFE that the lecturer came out and said, and one of the first things he says was, compromise was the position that both parties are going to lose. So for a long while I thought about that, and then I thought, well, no, that's not how I'm going to think. I'm going to make sure both parties win. So when I do a negotiation, while I might throw things in, red herrings and strategies and bits and pieces, the end result is that people still get a win-win on both sides.
Yeah, that's very important. I mean, you know, it really is testament to you and your character that you did walk away from that deal, because I know in my past there's plenty of deals that could be done and just because I could do the deal, but it wouldn't have been the right thing for the other person. And, you know, you end up sitting down doing a little consult for them as to, well, you've got to do this and then you should do that and this will make it better for you. And, you know, it's something that comes with knowledge. It's something that responsibility comes with the whole process of responsibility for the other person as well. You know, it's all very well to have, you know, greater knowledge and greater ability and whatever else, but if you're not creating a situation, if you're really putting the other person into a detrimental situation, that's not a good idea. And it's something you should walk away from and help them out if you can.
Yeah. The other thing that is very good in negotiation is time. And there's been a couple of deals where our original approach was a year before we actually really got down to talk about the nitty-gritty and the negotiation. So one deal we did, we put it forward. We put it forward as an option. We put it forward as a... I don't think we talked about a vendor JV at the time. It was about possibly...
JV being joint venture.
Joint venture, sorry. And eventually, a year later, all I wanted to do was I put the deal forward and he said no. Then I started to do the research, found out from the agent what was going on. Agents will tell you a lot of information, and so you can start to piece the picture together again. So did some research over the year, and he just wouldn't refuse to sit down with me. He wanted to talk about money. So really the reason he wanted to talk about money was because he was a financial stock market man and he worked numbers. So he didn't want to talk about the nitty-gritty. He wanted to make sure the price was talked about first, and I never talk about price. Sometimes in meetings I won't talk about price until the second meeting. We try and get the deal out some other way to make sure we work forward. So put the picture together that he was a finance man, stock market. He was probably a little bit desperate to sell because at the time the stock market had taken a big pounce. Went and did a title search on the property, found that there was a mortgage on the property even though it was an investment. He essentially wanted $2.4 million for his property. It was already six blocks of land. It was just not pretty. And there was a house on it that was going over three of the six blocks. So, you know, it wasn't appealing to any developer because there was a lot of work to be done in approvals and the market wasn't strong at the time. So a year later, we finally got to sit down with him and his wife and we started to talk about it. Like the first thing I said to him is, what I'm about to tell you right now, you can take away and you can do it yourself. I knew that he couldn't because he was suffering from the stock market and the rest of it, and he didn't have any cash available. We did have a little bit of cash available. And so we essentially what I said is no one's going to pay $2.4 million for those six blocks together, but they will buy individual blocks for a lot less, standard families that want to build a home. So what we'll do is we'll go in there and we'll put fences up. You couldn't access some of those blocks, so we had to create rights of carriageways and easements, which comes from the education component, that we knew how to do that. It was experience from our learning in the boot camps and all the packages that get sent out that you work from. So that sort of stuff there meant that I was placing myself in a position of knowledge where they were confident that we could do this together. With that deal there, had we purchased the deal and sold the blocks individually, we would have made no money because there was $120,000 in stamp duty alone.
Yeah.
So I said that to him. I said, essentially, the profit that we would be getting out of the deal is going to be lost in stamp duty. We're better off to do a deal together where we do the work on the property and we individually sell off the blocks. You can pay me a project management fee. You can pay us a percentage. As long as we get our money back plus a profit, it's not a problem. And eventually he agreed. And he's a 79, 80-year-old man. And his
wife. I didn't realize he was that old.
He's that old. So, so we did the deal there. We have sold now five out of the six properties. He's in line to get more than $2.4 million, and we're getting our money on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
I probably spent all of 2 or 3 weeks on the deal working. The rest of it was just project management.
And money. You put money into the deal.
I put some money into it. So we got our money back. Mm-hmm. So we put about $80,000 into the deal, and it looks like we'll get probably a little bit over $100,000 back.
Mm-hmm.
Which was a good deal.
Mm-hmm.
So at the same time, while we were talking to, at the end of one of the meetings, he said, just off the cuff, he says, I suppose you wouldn't want to do a deal, buy a house at Warunga. And I said, well, no, but I'll have a look at it. And so he said it was online, and the same thing, I painted the picture. There was a whole history of him trying to sell it, where they started from and all the rest of it. So the same thing, we went back to them and said, look, I think we can do something. It was a corner block, massive amount of area that we could subdivide. So we put the subdivision through. So we made a deal on that one too. We put the subdivision through, and we're just about to complete that. So that's all out of one deal. And in that situation, again, with his own home, he couldn't sell. He wanted a certain figure. And as long as we met that certain figure, he was quite happy. So the start of, we had the original conversation. Then in the second meeting, we said, look, we know how, if someone was to walk into the property right now, then you, and offered you $2.1 million, you would take it. And he said, yeah, I would. And I said, well, that's their starting price. So you need to get your $2 million. Let's do a deal there. I'll make sure you get your $2 million, and anything over that we can get to keep, or we split. And in this deal, we're splitting.
Good.
Yeah.
And, that's the thing. It's really that education is what gives you the parameters to be able to work with. It's all very well once we've got the attitude, okay, yes, during the boot camps and all the training that I do, we very much work on attitude. But attitude alone is not going to do it. It's attitude plus the knowledge to be able to implement the attitude. Implement, okay, well, what if we did this and what if we did that? And if, I can do it this way or that way, and really package it up, which is drawing on so many things that come in from all angles of training and learning and discussions with other individuals and ongoing ongoing learning. It's something the day you stop learning is the day you get in a box, I assume. It's really being able to draw in on all of that information to put it all together into one nice little neat package of a win-win situation.
Yeah, and with the education, it's got me to a position where there's not a deal where I don't think I can do. I look at every deal now and I go, well, knowing what I know and what I've learnt, then there's some way to do this deal. There's some way to be able to fund it, whether I need to bring someone in or, you know, so where I'm always thinking laterally, so is Christine, making sure that we can find some ways to fund a deal. Sometimes we're doing a deal, you know, only recently we found out that we couldn't get enough funding for a deal, so we're just thinking about different ways to do that. Who do we bring in? Who can help us out? You know, we may not make the full profit ourselves, but someone else, it's better than making no profit at all by bringing someone else in and sharing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, when you start to compound what we've talked about so far with mates in the market, you know, it really creates a strong force to be able to do whatever you want to go and do. And just having mates who are equally educated, who are equally active and motivated and have the right attitude and all of those sorts of things, it really is a tool, a very valuable situation. And, you know, just having the mates in the market doing it is great. You know, it's a social thing as much as a learning and growing and working together.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite often we send emails between the students and, you know, has anyone ever done a vendor finance deal or an options deal, or, you know, I've got this negotiation and it's not working in my favour, you know,
Anyone got any ideas? Any
ideas of how we could get this over the line, you know, any experience? And that helps so much, you know, when you've got people exactly that, the mates in the market that have done it before. And, you know, we haven't all done everything, and there's always some sort of experience somewhere that you can grab from someone else and use to your advantage.
And all of this stuff, you know, you start off with smaller deals. I think my first deal was on a milking cow. Can you top that one, Ian?
No.
Right, okay. You topped me with the bones of the cat, but no. No, but it was. My very first deal was a milking cow that my neighbour was going to send to the knackery. You know what a knackery is? It's where they chop up. It's where they chop up animals and turn them into pet food. I was horrified. I was only fairly little, and I was horrified that Blackie was her name, this milking cow. She was about 14 years old at the time, was going to be sent off to be turned into pet food. And I convinced the neighbour in exchange for some jobs and whatever else. I don't think I ever ended up doing very many of them. But anyway, I got Blackie the milking cow, and she went. I think she lived till she was over 16. So I kept her at least another couple of years before she died a natural death, and had I think she had three more calves, and those calves had calves and built up my herd. And that's actually what paid for my university. It was dear old Blackie.
It's fabulous.
Saved her from the knackery. I did.
Yes.
So anyway, that training, that early training, regardless of whether it's on, you know, Blackie the milking cow, or whether it's on a deal, a small deal, and the negotiation of that, right through to very large deals. And when you get into the bigger deals, you know, alternate funding and mezzanine funding and dealing with superannuation funds and private lenders, and, as you know, all of the outside the mainstream type funding really starts to draw on these skills of thinking outside the box and putting together a package. Okay, how can I make this happen and still tick all the boxes that everybody needs ticked? And, you know, it goes through right through to the very, very top. And the better you become at this, the more skilled you become at this, the better deals you'll do, the more deals you'll do, and the more money you're going to make.
Yeah, and you'll do more deals because you're more confident in making sure that it works, that the negotiation's going to work, that numbers work, that you can talk to people. And, you know, the risk was only slightly higher, but, you know, to most people the risk would be massive. But because you're educated, because you're confident, because you know how to negotiate, then, you know, you're doing a risk mitigation on that.
Yeah, and you're solutions-based as opposed to defeatist-based.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Ian, thank you so much for being on the podcast with me today. I know you're a wealth of information and a huge, you know, pillar of inspiration for all of my students and everyone listening to the podcast today. It's great for you to come on and share some of that knowledge with you and with my students and the listeners, and you know, to really see if people can step up to the mark and start to get out there and make some of the kind of profits that you've made over the last 4 years.
Yeah, well, I mean, thank you for having me here. But for me, I do enjoy talking about these sort of things, because if it means that someone else can go off, think about something in a different way and be more positive and get more confidence and you know, eventually replace income like a few of us have now, then that's, for me, a good thing. I love to see people. I like the stories. I get all emotional when people say that, you know, I've now left work, I'm employed by myself, or, as we like to term it, unemployable. but thank you for having me along.
Thank you, guys. Thank you for listening. And don't forget to jump on to iloverealestate.tv and subscribe to iTunes if you haven't. And if you haven't been on the website, jump on there and subscribe to the other information and freebies and all of the rest of the stuff that I've got on there. So thank you heaps, guys. Thank you, Ian. A wealth of information again. And I'll be back again to talk to you very, very soon about something completely different. Bye for now.